Well, good morning, church.
Good morning.
It is really great to be with you. We missed y'all last week. We enjoyed getting to be with my son and go to church with him there in Knoxville and celebrate. It was a day of Thanksgiving that's last Sunday in Knoxville, and so it was a lot of fun. It was good to be with him, but it's good to be back with you. I don't know if you got to see, but I got to hold a little boy today. That was pretty awesome. We got to hang out with Wesley's kids, and they sent Carter over at some point, incognito, and I just showed up. And the next thing I know, I'm holding him, and he's laying his head down like he was a little sleepy. So I gave him some coffee. He should be fine now. sent him back over, revved up and ready to go. But anyway, it's good to be with people who know you and who love you. That's a big part of it. Yesterday was one day, and I just got some statistics. I'm going to share them with you. We're not going to have just a whole lot of time to talk about all of it, but it was a great day. So yesterday, the numbers I were given were that we had 1,680 people come through. That's a lot of folks to come through. That's not to even counting the people who came to the day before, because some guys from Be the Bush, some girls from, ladies from Merriam House and Blue Monarch, there were some of the trustees from the jail who helped us set up. They got to come through a day early and get some clothing and coats and boots and those sorts of things. So that's a lot of people who just came through. There were over 300 volunteers yesterday. And that covers dozens of churches in our county and area. That's pretty amazing. There were over 1,400 coats that were given away. 1,400 coats. That one kind of blew my mind. That's an amazing statistic. Over 6,000 pairs of socks. 6,000 pairs of socks. And that's a lot of socks. But all the clothing, by the way, that was donated, we gave away as much as we could give away. But everything that wasn't taken yesterday was loaded up onto a semi-trailer and sent to East Tennessee to the victims of Hurricane Helene. So everything is being used. Together yesterday, we served, you know, all of these families, all of these individuals. And as Tommy mentioned, I got to be in the prayer tent, which is where you tend to get more personal contacts. I saw kids that have ridden my bus and their families. I saw people that have come through years before. I saw one young lady that I prayed with last year. And at the time, her marriage was, they were going through a divorce. And she had a little boy, young lady. And I thought it was amazing. She came yesterday. And I kind of recognized her. I don't have a real personal relationship, but I recognized her. And she said, yes, and I also came to your church a couple of Wednesday nights and came to your divorce care class that Doug and Diane did. And I was like, oh, that's right. And with her was her little boy and her husband, that their marriage had been reconciled, and they were now going to counseling to work on that. Just to see from year to year how those things make an impact in our community. And that's not to mention all of the, not only food and clothing, but there were medical needs and dental needs and legal needs and employment needs. And there was, books for kids and adults. There were boxes of toiletries and haircuts. And, I mean, it's just so much going on that day. But most importantly, we were touching lives. I mean, that was the amazing thing, is that we were touching lives. I got to have a conversation with Tasha from Merriam House. She came out to the prayer tent for a little while. We were just talking about when you touch a life, when you make a difference in that one person, you're not just making a difference in that one person. You're making a difference in families. You're making differences in entire communities of people. When they see someone who has... In their case, when they're working with people with addiction, you know, someone who's torn a tornado through a family, just leaving a path of destruction in their wake, and they receive someone back who is sorrowful and repentant, and it's changing. And when these families that we work with yesterday, it's certainly not on that scale, but all those folks go home, and for you know, for a little while, they don't have to worry about, oh, I've got to get a haircut. I know I need to do that. Or I've got to get to the dentist. I've got to get my kids to the dentist. Or I've got to get this medical problem taken care of. Or how am I going to get us winter coats? I mean, just all these little things that sort of stack up on you. And if you've got money and time and means, it's not that big a deal. When you don't have those things, it becomes a greater and greater weight of pressure and guilt and fear. And some of those people have been carried that around on an almost constant basis. So just to give a little lift to that burden, it's a big deal. And I so appreciate the folks who have the, not just the heart, but the ability to put all that together. It's a massive, massive undertaking. And one other thing, I don't know if y'all saw this, but since it's Facebook official, I'm going to announce it, is that Garrett and Bailey are having a baby. Did y'all know that? Just Garrett today, but maybe Bailey later. But it's a baby boy, and so we are so excited for them, so excited for their families, and I think David's going to try to get his act together and be an elder, and that's just great the way their family is turning around. That's so good. I'm so thankful for their family and their the importance that they have been, not only now in our congregation, but over the years. Such a big deal. I want to start by telling you a story. It's not a true story, just in case you go away from here and quote this. But there once was a man whose name was Reginald Danforth III. This is actually him. And Reggie, as the people called him, he thought he knew everything. He'd argue with experts. He would correct seasoned veterans in whatever field they were in. He generally dismissed the ideas of anyone who disagreed with him. He was just, we might say, is a know-it-all, right? Well, one day, Reggie decides, you know what, I think I can build a better boat than anybody else out there. Not just any boat. I'm going to build the best boat that's ever been built. And sure enough, true to form, he ignored the advice of all the expert boat builders and nautical engineers or whatever that is. He just decided, you know, with my high intelligence and my quality internet research, I am more than well equipped to build the best boat ever. And sure enough, when he built this boat, it looked amazing. It looked unlike anything anybody had ever seen in shipbuilding. So when it came down to launch, Reggie was brimming with confidence, and he climbed aboard, and he untied the ropes, and he pushed off out into the harbor, and the boat promptly began to list side to side. It took on a little more water each time it rolled from side to side, and then before long, water's just pouring in, and Reggie's clinging to the side of his vessel, and from the shore, people could hear Reggie yell, "I knew it would work." So the Coast Guard sends out a rescue team. And this rescue team, as ever, gets out there to save him. And Reggie, by this time, he is sputtering, and the wreckage is dragging him downward. He's floundering in these dangerous waters now. And he begins yelling, "Hey, hey, hey." And as the sailor reached out to this drowning man, Reggie finally was able to get his head above water and say, "Actually, you're doing this all wrong." And he started correcting. You know people like that? Do you know people who just seem to have all the answers? When people seem to have all the answers, they kind of become like Reginald, whatever his last name was, Danforth III. It's completely made up. But you cannot save some people from themselves, right? Well, as we come towards the end of our, we're getting close to the end of our minor prophet study, and we're now at the end of the book of Zephaniah. We're going to meet some people like that. People who know better than anyone else. People who are really sure of themselves. They are confident in their knowledge. They are assured of their standing and place in this world, and who couldn't be more wrong. This is the way Zephaniah chapter 3 opens up. God says, "Woe to the city of the oppressors, rebellious and defiled. She obeys no one. She accepts no correction." By the way, for the first part of this, and I'm just going to pause right here. We're going to pick up in just a sec. He doesn't say who it is. He just calls it the city. And if you go back to chapter 2, the end of chapter 2, he's going through, he's talking about the downfall of Assyria. Now, Assyria was a big, mighty power. It had conquered the northern tribe of Israel and carried Israel off. And they had they'd subjugated the southern kingdom of Judah. And Judah was just like under Assyria's thumb and having to pay this heavy taxation. And so God doesn't name, he just calls it this city. And then you're thinking about, this may be talking about the downfall of Assyria, which is going to come, by the way. Babylon is going to take over Assyria. So we might assume, right along with the first readers of Zephaniah or the first hearers of this sermon, that the city he's talking about is Nineveh, the capital of Assyria. Same Nineveh that Jonah went to centuries before. I mean, it fits. You look at the language. You've got oppressors. Who's a better oppressor than Assyria, right? So he's talking about Nineveh. Rebellious. I mean, who's more rebellious? They sacrifice children to gods and defiled. I mean, they are just pillaging the land. What better way to describe the heathen city of Nineveh than oppressors, rebellious, and defiled? But then Zephaniah continues on. And he still doesn't name the city, but he starts describing some things. She does not trust in the Lord. She does not draw near to her God. And this phrasing, this wording, this language puts the reader on notice that he is not talking about Nineveh. He's not talking about some foreign city. This is not about those idol worshipers over there. This is about them. This is about Judah. This is about Jerusalem. He's drawing this comparison. He's using the same language he would use to talk about Nineveh, but he's now talking about Jerusalem. This comparison between Jerusalem and Nineveh, it is not a flattering comparison. And it's like saying, oh, man, I'm trying to think of a good way to say it. Nashville is really growing and changing. I'll tell you what, it's becoming like the Vegas of the Southeast. Right? In the right person's mouth, you would know that's not actually a compliment. Right? Some people might say it as a compliment, but coming from the Lord, you would know, probably not a good thing that we're compared to a city known for gambling and prostitution and organized crime. Probably not what he wants. So this comparison between Jerusalem and Nineveh, not a flattering comparison. Because they are explicitly described as sinning. And the first sins he listed, if you go through the first five verses, he talks about all these sins, and there's like seven sins that are listed against God. And then he talks about like six more that are against their fellow man. This comparison between Jerusalem and Nineveh, they are more similar than they are different. Oppression, for instance, we're not going to have time to go through all of the sins. But oppression is the first sin, and it's a sin against God, which, if you think, well, what is oppression? Oppression is taking advantage of the poor. So you're, wait a minute. Oppression is not a sin against God. Oppression is a sin against the poor, against your fellow man. But here's the thing. God always takes oppression as a personal affront to him. Oppression is not just physical brutality like an army coming in and taking over. Oppression of the poor, it's taking food out of the mouths of the poor so that you can line your pockets better. It's paying people less than what they've earned for you as their employer. It's taking those people to court, even though they're right, because you know they can't afford the court fees. You know they can't afford to fight back. You know they can't take this much time off work. oppression of the poor is taking advantage of the circumstances. It's limiting the market of food so that people are starving and saying, I'll tell you what I'll do. Since you're starving, out of the goodness of my heart, I'll buy you as a slave $10. Let's just call it $10, and then I'll feed you a little bit. That's oppression of the poor. And that's not what's going on in Nineveh. That's what's going on with God's people in Jerusalem. God's problem with Nineveh was that they were being pagans. God's problem with his people, who knew better, was that they were also being pagans. And it's like same thing with idolatry. Of course you expect Nineveh to have idolatry. But it's not just about those other gods, as awful as they are. The other gods are not the heart of the problem. The real heart of the problem is the heart of God's people. The problem is not that those other gods are out there and that they're supposedly, by the way, these gods are dead. They're not real. So anyone who's compelling you to sacrifice children to other gods, it's not the gods, it's the people. Anyone who's compelling you to sell or tear or take or give or do all these other things, it's not the gods, it's the people who are compelling you to do that. That's the joke is on them. That it's not the gods forcing them to do this. It's themselves. And that idolatry we expect to be going on in Nineveh, but it's also going on right in Jerusalem. And some people, the trick here is not that they've gone into the temple of the Lord and they've taken out all the God stuff and they put in all the idol stuff. No. It's much more sneaky and subtle than that. Because we're still going to worship the Lord our God. We're just going to also worship these other gods to cover these other areas. We're going to trust in God for these things. We're going to trust in these other gods for these other things. We're going to trust in God to make us holy, but we're going to trust in this other God to make us a strong army. We're going to trust in God to accept our sacrifices for forgiveness, but we're going to trust in these other gods to make us rich. Right? We're going to trust a little bit here and a little bit there. And God said, when you do that, you're not trusting me at all. So you got oppression, you've got idolatry, and then he calls the governors, the word there for princes or governors, the people who will facilitate, they're the ones who collect the taxes and all that stuff. He calls them roaring lions, which if you remember back to Nahum, also talking about Assyria, the army of Assyria was called Roaring Lions. That was their name. You know, like we have team mascots. You know, the Tennessee Titans or the Tennessee Volunteers or the Alabama Elephants or whatever it may be. Right? We all have... they have mascots. You have names, nicknames. Absolutely. Well, the armies also had nicknames. And we sort of have that for some units in our military. The Screaming Eagles or I don't know any others. That's the only one I know. Anyway, we have these nicknames for the military. Well, the nickname for Assyria's military was the lions. And he says, you rulers are the roaring lions. Basically, cowering people, roaring, scaring people, which is a fantastic thing to do if you're a ruler, you're trying to get more power. You just need to scare people. Just give them the good roar. If you don't do what I say, if you don't, we're not going here, but if you don't vote this way, then all this bad stuff's going to happen. You ever heard that? You can watch any cable news network, and I don't even care which one it is. Their number one job is not to inform you. Their number one job is to scare you, which is why people who watch cable news network all day are less happy and more depressed than anyone else in our country. If just the truth set you free, why are people so sad and depressed? Because their job is not to inform you, it's to scare you. These rulers, these leaders, their job was not to lead the people. In their minds, their job was to scare the people. And then he goes on to talk about the other authorities, and he's talking about the judges. It's another word that they use for judges. The judges were corrupt, which meant that they were ruling in favor of their rich friends who could give them something in return. It doesn't matter that the poor person is right. It doesn't matter that the poor person is being taken advantage of. If you know the judge, you can buy the judge. And that's what they were doing. Not in Nineveh. This is not an out there problem. This was a problem among God's people. So church, I'm not talking about America. This is us. This is not an American problem or a North American problem or a European problem or a world problem. This is an us problem. Because they are not the people of God. The church is the people of God. They are not Israel of God by faith. The church is Israel of God by faith. So all of these are problems. But behind all of these problems, and they're big problems, but they're not the biggest problem. The biggest problem is found as a theme that runs throughout this chapter, and you can see it as you just read through it. It's a pretty short chapter. I'd encourage you to read it. We don't have time to read the whole thing this morning. But the theme that runs through this chapter is that they are too arrogant to accept correction. Although, you know, we talked about that back up in verse 2. That's what it said. They refused to accept correction. Or down in verse 5, the unrighteous know no shame. Verse 7, surely Jerusalem will accept correction. But then he goes on to say, but you won't. And then later on down in the chapter, towards the very end of the book of Zephaniah, God turns and he starts making promises. He's like, all these things are bad. And he says, I'm going to set the world on fire. I'm going to destroy everything. And by that, he's not talking about the end of time. Though if you just read that verse by itself, you might think that. You find out later there's all these people after the whole world is destroyed. So he doesn't mean that in a literal sense. But he says, I'm going to bring everybody together. I'm going to lower the boom, and things are going to change. And God makes a promise to Judah of restoration. A promise to do something great with Jerusalem in the future. And this is what he says in verse 11. On that day, you, Jerusalem, will not be put to shame. Pause real quick. Something that's really cool as you go back through this chapter. He talks in the third person. They, them, that city. It's all they up until you get to the end and the promises. And it goes from third person to second person. I'm no longer talking to them, because them has been changed into you. And by that, he means that he's fixed the problem. He is fixing the problem that is at the heart of what's going on in Jerusalem. So now it's no longer just them out there. This is you. We're being specific. On that day, you, Jerusalem, will not be put to shame for all the wrongs you have done to me, because I will remove from you your arrogant boasters. Never again will you be haughty on my holy hill, but I will leave within you the meek and the humble. The remnant of Israel will trust in the name of the Lord. God promises here to purify Jerusalem. Kind of like we see from Isaiah. Remember when Isaiah gets this vision of heaven and heaven opens up and he sees the throne room of God and he's standing in this throne room and God comes in and he's like, you know, woe to me, for I'm a man of unclean lips and I live among a people of unclean lips. You know, I'm going to be undone because I know I'm not worthy to even be here. And God commands this divine being to take this coal, this hot coal from the altar, and when the tongs touch it to Isaiah's lips, and all of a sudden God takes away that impurity and makes him worthy to serve, worthy to carry the message. God does the same thing, not just with one individual prophet like Isaiah, but with the whole city of Jerusalem, which stands for the whole nation of Judah. God is promising to purify the whole lot of them, the whole remnant of them. And this promise for purification involves removing what has led them astray, involves all the governors and the judges and the priests, all the people who practice idolatry and take advantage of the poor. But at the center of that problem is this arrogance, the unwillingness or the inability, maybe they should call it the inability, to accept correction. Because if you don't have the humility to admit that you've been wrong, if you don't have the humility to admit that you've sinned, that you've fallen short, that you might not know everything, if you don't have that humility, you cannot take God's warnings to heart. If you don't have that humility, you cannot change. And that's what God's telling them to do. Over and over and over and over and over, God has sent them warning and message and warning and message and warning and message. And by now, the whole northern kingdom of Israel has been carried away. And by now, the nation of Assyria has begun to crumble as Babylon takes over. And all these, the nation of Egypt has been dealt a fatal blow. All these things are happening around them, but they're so sure and so confident and so arrogant in who they are that they cannot take these warnings. Surely that's somebody else. Surely that's a them problem, not a me problem. Surely God's talking about them over there, not me. The arrogance to say that in the face of God's prophet. The arrogance to say when addressed, and you see that, to say, oh, well, that's not my fault. That's somebody else's. Somebody else made me do that, or somebody else did that. Have you ever been around people who could never take the blame for anything? You ever been around people like that? You work with them, and something goes wrong with a project or something you're doing, and it's never their fault. Do you know what people I'm talking about? Don't stop pointing. You know the kind of people we're talking about, though? Who can never say, it was my fault. I should have done this, or I didn't do that. Who never have the humility to take responsibility, those are the people who cannot change. And if you've ever had the displeasure of working with or under or alongside or over someone that arrogant, you know how hard it is to get them to change. And God is looking at his people and saying, that's who you have become. You've become so hard-headed, I don't know how else to get through to you. I still love you. I still want you. And so I'm going to take out of you a remnant. I'm going to take out of you this arrogance, this hard-heartedness, this love for yourself. I'm going to take that out of you and leave you humble and moldable and shapeable and ready to listen. I need people who can listen. And this morning, church, that's what God's looking for. He's not looking for the people who have it all together. You may look around and think, but I don't know anything. I don't know. I didn't even know there was a book of Zephaniah. I don't know all of the Beatitudes. And I know my life doesn't live up to that. And I don't even know all the Lord's Prayer by heart. And I'm sure don't know I don't live that. And you may have all of these reasons why you're not good enough. And let me tell you, that's what makes you absolutely perfect in the hands of a perfect God. The ability to say, I know I'm not good enough, is key to being a person of God. That's exactly what he's looking for. And if this morning you know you don't measure up, your God is here for you. Not to destroy you, but to make you into one of his, all of his. This morning, if we can lift you up and pray with you for forgiveness, for strength, for direction, or to commit your life to Jesus Christ, have your sins washed away, we want you to come now while we stand and while we sing.